And I'm continuing to read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams. And today we are on Chapter 3. On this particular Thursday, something was moving quietly through the ionosphere, many miles above the surface of the planet. Several somethings, in fact. Several dozen huge, yellow, chunky, slab-like somethings. Huge as office blocks, silent as birds. They soared with ease, basking in the electromagnetic rays from the star soul, biding their time, grouping, preparing. The planet beneath them was almost perfectly oblivious of their presence, which was just how they wanted it for the moment. The huge yellow somethings went unnoticed at Gunhilly. They passed over Cape Canaveral without a blip. Woomera and Jordral Bank looked straight through them, which was a pity, because it was exactly the sort of thing they'd been looking for all these years. The only place they registered at all was on a small black device called a sub-ether sensomatic, which winked away quietly to itself. It nestled in the darkness inside a leather satchel, which Ford Prefect habitually wore and slung around his neck. The content of Ford's satchel were quite interesting, in fact, and would have made any Earth's physician's eyes pop out of his head, which is why he always concealed them by keeping a couple of dog-eared scripts for plays he was pretending to be auditioning for, stuffed in on top of them. Besides the sub-ether sensomatic and the scripts, he had an electric thumb, a short, squat, black rod, smooth and matte, with a couple of flat switches and dials at one end. He also had a device which looked rather like a largish electronic calculator. This had about 150 tiny flat press buttons and a screen about 4 inches square on which any one of a million pages could be summoned at a moment's notice. It looked insanely complicated, and this was one of the reasons why the snug plastic cover it fitted into had the words "Don't Panic" printed on it in large friendly letters. The other reason was this device was, in fact, the most remarkable of all books ever come out of the great publishing corporation of Ursa Minor, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. The reason why it was published in the form of a micro-sub Mensen electronic component is that, if it were printed in the normal book form, an interstellar hitchhiker would require several inconveniently large buildings to carry it around in. Beneath that, in Ford Prefect's satchel, were a few biros, a notepad, and a largish bath towel from Marks and Spencer. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy has a few things to say on the subject of towels. A towel, it says, is about the most massively useful thing an interstellar hitchhiker can have. Partly, it has great practical value. You can wrap it around you for warmth as you bound across the cold moons of Jaglan Beta. You can lie on it on the brilliant marble-sanded beaches of Sidraginous V, inhaling the heady sea vapors. You can sleep under it, or on it, beneath the stars which shine on redly, which shine so redly on the desert world of Kafrakoon. Use it to sail a mini-raft down the slow, heavy river Moth. Wet it for use in hand-to-hand combat, wrap it around your head to ward off noxious fumes, or avoid the gaze of the ravenous bug-bladder beast. A mind-bogglingly stupid animal, it assumes that if you can't see it, it can't see you. Daft as a bush, but very, very ravenous. You can wave your towel in emergencies as a distress signal, and, of course, dry yourself off with it, if it still seems clean enough. More importantly, a towel has immense psychological value. For some reason, if a strag non-hitchhiker, discovers that a hitchhiker has his towel with him, he automatically assumes that he's also in possession of a toothbrush, face flannel, soap, tin of biscuits, flask, compass, map, ball of string, gnat spray, wet weather gear, spacesuit, etc., etc. Furthermore, the strag will then happily lend the hitchhiker any of these or a dozen other items the hitchhiker might have accidentally lost. What the strag will think is that if any man who can hitch the length of the and breadth of the galaxy, rough it, slum it, struggle against terrible odds, win through, and still know where his towel is clearly a man to be reckoned with. Hence a phrase which has passed into hitchhiking slang, as in, "Hey, you sass that whoopee hoopee Ford Prefect, there's a fruit who really knows where his towel is." Sass, No, be aware of, meet, have sex with, hoopy, really together guy, frood, really amazingly together guy. Nestling quietly on top of the towel in Ford Prefect's satchel, the sub-ether sensomatic began to wink more quickly. Miles above the surface of the planet, the huge yellow somethings began to fan out. At Jordral Bank, someone decided it was time for a nice relaxing cup of tea. "You got a towel with you?" said Ford suddenly to Arthur. Arthur, struggling through his third pint, looked around at him. "Why? What? No. Should I have?" He had given up being surprised. There didn't seem to be any point any longer. Ford clicked his tongue in irritation. "Drink up," he urged. At that moment, the dull sound of a rumbling crash from the outside filtered through the low murmur of the pub, through the sound of the jukebox, through the sound of the man next to Ford hiccuping over the whiskey Ford had eventually bought him. Arthur choked on his beer, leapt to his feet. "What's that?" he yelped. "Don't worry," said Ford. "They haven't started yet." "Thank God for that," said Arthur, and relaxed. "It's probably just your house being knocked down," said Ford, downing his pint. "What?" shouted Arthur. Suddenly, Ford's spell was broken. Arthur looked wildly around him and ran to the window. "My God, they are! They're knocking my house down! What the hell am I doing in the pub, Ford?" "It hardly makes any difference at this stage," said Ford. "Let them have their fun." "Fun?" yelped Arthur. "Fun?" He quickly checked out of the window again that they were talking about the same thing. "Damn their fun," he hooted and ran out of the pub, furiously waving a nearly empty beer glass. He made no friends at all in the pub that lunchtime. "Stop, you vandals, you homewreckers," bawled Arthur. "You half-crazed Visigoths, stop, will you?" Ford would have to go after him. Quickly, turning to the barman, he asked for 4 packets of peanuts. "There you are, sir," said the barman, slapping the peanuts on the bar. 28 pence, if you'd be so kind." Ford was very kind. He gave the bartender another 5-pound note and told him to keep the change. The barman looked at it and then looked at Ford. He suddenly shivered. He experienced a momentary sensation that he didn't understand because no one on earth had ever experienced it before. In moments of great stress, every life form that exists gives out a tiny subliminal signal. This signal simply communicates an exact and almost pathetic sense of how far that being is from the place of its birth. On Earth, it is never possible to be further than 16,000 miles from your birthplace, which really isn't very far. So such signals are too minimal, too minute to be noticed. Ford Prefect was at this moment under great stress. And he was born 600 light-years away in the near vicinity of Betelgeuse. The barman reeled for a moment, hit by a shocking, incomprehensible sense of distance. He didn't know what it meant, but as he looked at Ford Prefect, he found a new sense of respect, almost awe. "Are you serious, sir?" he said in a small whisper, which had the effect of silencing the pub. "You think the world's going to end?" "Yes," said Ford. "But this afternoon?" Ford had recovered himself. He was his flippest. "Yes," he said gaily, "in less than 2 minutes, I would estimate." The barman couldn't believe this conversation he was having, but he couldn't believe the sensation that he had had either. "Isn't there anything we can do about it?" he said. "No, nothing," said Ford, stuffing the peanuts into his pocket. Someone in the hushed bar suddenly laughed raucously at how stupid everyone had become. The man sitting next to Ford was a bit sozzled by now. His eyes weaved their way up to Ford. "I thought," he said, "that if the world was going to end, we were meant to lie down or put a paper bag over our head or something." "If you like, yes," said Ford. "That's what they told us in the army," said the man. His eyes began the long trek back down towards his whiskey. "Will that help?" asked the barman. "No," said Ford, and gave him a friendly smile. "Excuse me," he said, "I've got to go." With a wave, he left. The pub was silent for a long moment. A moment longer, and then, embarrassingly enough, the man with the raucous laugh did it again. The girl he had dragged along to the pub with him had grown to loathe him dearly over the last hour, and it would probably have been a great satisfaction to her to know that in a moment and a half or so, he would suddenly evaporate into a whiff of hydrogen, ozone, and carbon monoxide. However, when the moment came, she would be too busy evaporating herself to notice it. The barman cleared his throat. He heard himself say, "Last orders, please." The huge yellow machines began to sink downwards and to move faster. Ford knew they were there. This wasn't the way he had wanted it. Running up the lane, Arthur had nearly reached his house. He didn't notice how cold it was, how cold it had suddenly become. He didn't notice the wind. He didn't notice the sudden, irrational qual of rain. He didn't notice anything but the caterpillar bulldozers crawling over the rubble that had been his home. "You barbarians," he yelled. "I'll sue the council for every penny it's got. I'll have you hung, drawn, and quartered, and whipped, and boiled, until you've had enough." Ford was running after him very fast. Very, very fast. "And then I will do it again," yelled Arthur. "And when I've finished, I'll take all the little bits and I will jump on them." Arthur didn't notice that the men were running from the bulldozers. He didn't notice that Mr. Prosser was staring hectically into the sky. What Mr. Prosser had noticed was that huge yellow somethings were screaming through the clouds. Impossibly huge yellow somethings. "And I will carry on jumping on them," yelled Arthur, still running, "until I get blisters, or I can think of anything even more unpleasant to do. And then..." Arthur tripped. He fell headlong, rolled, and landed flat on his back. At last he noticed that something was going on. His finger shot upward. "What the hell's that?" he shrieked. Whatever it was raced across the sky in its monstrous yellowness, tore the sky apart with mind-buggering noise, and leapt off into the distance, leaving the gaping air to shut behind it with a bang that drove your ears 6 feet into your skull. Another one followed and did exactly the same thing, only louder. It's difficult to say exactly what the people on the surface of the planet were doing now, because they didn't really know what they were doing themselves. None of it made a lot of sense. Running into houses, running out of houses, howling noiselessly at the noise. All around the city, all around the world, city streets exploded with people. Cars slewed into each other as the noise fell on them and then rolled off like a tidal wave over hills and valleys, deserts and oceans, seeming to flatten everything it hit. Only one man stood and watched the sky, stood with terrible sadness in his eyes, and rubber bungs in his ears. He knew exactly what was happening, and had known ever since his sub-ether sensomatic had started winking in the dead of night beside his pillow and woken him with a start. It was what he had waited for all these years, but when he had deciphered the signal pattern, sitting alone in his dark, small room, a coldness had gripped him and squeezed his heart. Of all the races in all of the galaxy, who could have come and said a big hello to planet Earth, he thought. Didn't it just have to be the Vogons? Still, he knew what he had to do. As the Vogon craft screamed through the air high above him, he opened his satchel. He threw away a copy of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. He threw away a copy of Godspell. He wouldn't need them where he was going. Everything was ready. Everything was prepared. He knew where his towel was. A sudden silence hit the earth. If anything was worse than the noise, for a while... If anything, it was worse than the noise. For a while, nothing happened. The great ships hung motionless in the sky, over every nation on Earth. Motionless they hung, huge, heavy, steady in the sky, a blasphemy against nature. Many people went straight into shock, as their minds tried to encompass what they were looking at. The ships hung in the sky in much the same way that bricks don't. And still nothing happened. Then there was a slight whisper. A sudden, spacious whisper of open, ambient sound. Every hi-fi set in the world, every radio, every television, every cassette recorder, every woofer, every tweeter, every mid-range driver in the world quietly turned itself on. Every tin can, every dustbin, every window, every car, every wine glass, every sheet of rusty metal became activated as an acoustically perfect sounding board. Before the Earth passed away, it was going to be treated to the very ultimate in sound production. Sound reproduction, the greatest public address system ever built. But there was no concert, no music, no fanfare. Just a simple message. "People of Earth, your attention, please," a voice said. And it was wonderful. Wonderful, perfect, quadraphonic sound with distortion levels so low as to make a brave man weep. This is Prostetnik Vogon Jeltz of the Galactic Hyperspace Planning Council, the voice continued. As you will no doubt be aware, the plans for development of the outlying regions of the galaxy require the building of a hyperspatial express route through your star system. And regrettably, your planet is one of those scheduled for demolition. The process will take slightly less than 2 of your Earth minutes. Thank you. The PA died away. Uncomprehending terror settled on the watching people of Earth. The terror moved slowly through the gathering crowds as if they were iron filings on a sheet of board and a magnet was moving underneath them. Panic sprouted again. Desperate, fleeing panic. But there was nowhere to flee to. Observing this, the Vogon turned on his PA again. It said, "There's no point in acting all surprised about it. All the planning charts and demolition orders have been on display in your local planning department in Alpha Centauri for 50 of your Earth years. So you've had plenty of time to lodge any formal complaint, and it's far too late to start making a fuss about it now." The PA fell silent again, and its echo drifted off across the land. The huge ships turned slowly in the sky with easy power. On the underside of each, a hatchway opened. An empty black square. At this time, someone somewhere must have manned a radio transmitter, located a wavelength, and broadcast a message back to the Vogon ships to plead on behalf of the planet. Nobody ever heard what they said. They only heard the reply. The PA slammed back into life. The voice was annoyed. It said, "What do you mean? You've never been to Alpha Centauri. For heaven's sake, mankind, it's only 4 light years away, you know. I'm sorry, but if you can't even be bothered to take an interest in local affairs, that's your own lookout. Energize the demolition beams." Light poured out of the hatchways. "I don't know," said the voice on the PA. "Apathetic bloody planet. I've no sympathy at all." It cut off. There was a terribly ghastly silence. There was a terribly ghastly noise. There was a terribly ghastly silence. The Vogon constructor fleet coasted away into the inky starry void. Chapter 4. Far away on the opposite spiral arm of the galaxy, 500,000 light-years from the star's soul, Zaphod Beeblebrox, president of the Imperial Galactic Government, sped across the seas of the Morgan with his ion-drive delta boat winking and flashing in the Dremorgan sun. Dremorgan the hot, Dremorgan the remote, Dremorgan the almost totally unheard of. Dremorgan, secret home of the Heart of Gold. The boat sped across the water. It would be some time before it reached its destination, because Dremorgan is such an inconveniently arranged planet. It consists of nothing but middling to large desert islands separated by very pretty but annoyingly wide stretches of ocean. The boat sped on. Because of this topographical awkwardness, Dremorgan has always remained a deserted planet. This is why the Imperial Galactic Government chose Dremorgan for the Heart of Gold project, because it was so deserted and the Heart of Gold project was so secret. The boat zipped and skipped across the ocean, the sea that lay between the main islands of the only archipelago of any useful size on the whole planet. Zaphod Beeblebrox was on his way from the tiny spaceport on Easter Island. The name was an entirely meaningless coincidence. In galactic speak, Easter means small, flat, and light brown. To the Heart of Gold Island, which, by another meaningless coincidence, was called France. One of the side effects of work on the Heart of Gold was a whole string of pretty meaningless coincidences. But it was not in any way a coincidence that today, the day of culmination of the project, the great day of unveiling, the day that the Heart of Gold was finally to be introduced to a marveling galaxy, was also a great day of culmination for Zaphod Beeblebrox. It was for the sake of this day that he had first decided to run for presidency, a decision which had sent shockwaves of astonishment through the Imperial Galaxy. Zaphod Beeblebrox, president. Not the Zaphod Beeblebrox. Not the president. Many had seen it as clinching proof that the world of known creation had finally gone bananas. Zaphod grinned and gave the boat an extra kick of speed. Zaphod Beeblebrox, explorer, ex-hippie, good-timer, crook, quite possibly, maniac self-publicist, terribly bad at personal relationships, often thought to be completely out to lunch. President? No one had gone bananas. Not in that way, at least. Only 6 people in the entire galaxy understood the principle on which the galaxy was governed, and they knew that once Zaphod Beeblebrox had announced his intention to run as president, it was more or less a fait accompli. He was ideal presidency fodder. Here an asterisk. President. Full-time president of the Imperial Galactic Government. The term imperial is kept, though it is now an anachronism. The hereditary emperor is nearly dead and has been for many centuries. In the last moments of his dying coma, he was locked in a static field which keeps him in a state of perpetual unchangingness. All his heirs are now long dead, and this means that without any drastic political upheaval, power has simply and effectively moved a rung or two down the ladder, and is now seen to be vested in a body which used to act simply as advisors to the emperor. An elected government assembly headed by a president elected by that assembly. In fact, it vests in no such place. The president in particular is very much a figurehead. He wields no real power whatsoever. He's apparently chosen by the government, but the qualities he is required to display are not those of leadership, but those of finely judged outrage. For this reason, the president is always a controversial choice, although an infuriating but fascinating character. His job is not to wield power, but to draw attention away from it. On those criteria, Zaphod Beeblebrox is one of the most successful presidents the galaxy has ever had. He has already spent 2 of his 10 presidential years in prison for fraud. Very, very few people realize that the president and the government have virtually no power at all. And of those few people, only 6 know whence ultimate political power is wielded. Most of the others secretly believe that the ultimate decision-making process is handled by a computer. They couldn't be more wrong.